Hello, Maine Healthcare team. It's good to be with you today. And I certainly hope all of you have been out there positively identifying the patient in front of you and washing your hands before engaging in care. Well, we've got a great program today. I'm super excited. We've got Linda Chaudron, who's our Maine Health Vice President of Medical Education with us to talk about all the things that are going on in medical education across our entire footprint. In addition to that, I want to start with a couple of sort of important things to talk about. One is we've talked a lot about pennies over the last couple of years and our finances and thinking about ways that we can improve our current situation. We've lost money for the last couple of years. And so as we're moving through this fiscal year, 2024, I wanted to let you know that we have finished the first quarter a little bit ahead of where we expected to. We actually made money the first quarter. Doesn't mean that all of our challenges are behind us. In fact, we've got plenty of headwinds ahead of us that we're going to have to keep navigating through. So we still have to be really diligent and paying attention and thinking about how we can continue to improve our performance over time. But just wanted to let you know there's a little bit of good news on that front. In addition to that, one of the things that's going to be happening this year is we're combining licenses at Maine Medical Center and Southern Maine Healthcare and really making all of that, you know, functionally one big hospital. And that's going to create some advantages for us, including the opportunity to fund 30% more graduate medical education, which means we'll have more residents and fellows in our system, which is great for us for lots of reasons that Linda will probably share with us a little bit later today. But it also means that we'll be having to change some names. So Southern Maine will now become Maine Medical Center as their licenses are all one. And if you remember last year, we talked about the fact that we'll be starting a rebranding this year, really becoming one Maine Health team. And so on that front, you're going to start to see that happen as we start to combine Maine Medical Center and Southern Maine, and you'll start to seeing this happen everywhere else across our system as well. And you may say, gosh, Andy, what does rebranding have to do with achieving our vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America? And the reality is quite a bit. And so as you go across our system today, because each of our local health systems at one point was an independent health system, we have different names for everything. So in one of our hospitals, radiology may be called radiology. In another hospital, it may be called diagnostic services. And that's awfully confusing to our patients. And so we think about our first value of patient-centered when we think about the rebranding. We will now really have consistency in what we call things all across Maine Health. We'll be using geographic identifiers to really make it easier for patients to figure out where they need to go, whether it's a hospital, physician practice, or other healthcare offering. And in addition to that, it helps create that sense of team for our patients so they understand that no matter where they go in the system, we know them and we care about them. And that's going to make care a lot better for many of our patients. In fact, Ross Izaki, who serves as our chief medical officer at Franklin Community Health Network, comments that, you know, he's had the privilege of practicing both at Maine Medical Center and at Franklin Community Health Network as a hospitalist. And sometimes when he's practicing at Franklin, patients will say, gosh, I'm nervous about being transferred to Maine Medical Center. I don't know what that's going to be like and who's going to take care of me. And Ross is able to flip over his badge and show his Maine Medical Center badge and say, look, they're just part of us. They know you down there. And then the same happens when he has patients who are ready to go back to Franklin Community Health Network. And he says, well, will they be able to continue to provide the great care that I've received at Maine Medical Center? He can turn his badge over and say, yes. As a matter of fact, you're part of the same team. They know you and are ready for you, and they can continue to deliver that same great care. In the future, we'll have badges that all look the same, and so people will understand that they're going to get the same level of great care and experience in all of our facilities. So this is really ultimately, at the end of the day, about our patients. And it's also about all of you as a care team, too. And I lived through a system rebranding many years ago. And frankly, I thought it was a bad idea to do that at first. And I kind of fought against it. But afterwards, I have to tell you, I was overwhelmed by the impact that it made. It really did make things easier for our patients, and I saw that as a practicing family physician. There was a sense that patients understood, if I go to that facility, they'll know me. And that was very comforting for patients. And it also really created a tremendous sense of teamwork and team pride. And so for all of those reasons, we'll be initiating that effort later this year. All right, Caroline, we've got a great program today.
We do. Yeah. Hopefully you can't. It doesn't look like I'm crying. I got something in my eye right at the end of you talking, and now it looks like I'm tearing up over the branding, but I'm really not. It's just I got something in my eye.
Yeah, I didn't. That wasn't the intent
I apologize. But yes, we do have a great program. Really excited to have Linda on the program. Also want to remind people, we do have some questions that came in ahead of time. But if you've got a question for Linda or for Andy, you can put them in the chat. Please put your first and last name and pronouns. And we will only use your first name. But if you don't want us to use your first name, just let me know that as well in the chat. And that's it. Let's get right to it because there's so much to talk about with medical education.
Absolutely. Linda, thank you for being with us today. We're excited to have you. So Linda, you've got a pretty fascinating background. So you've done a lot of different things in your career. So tell us a little bit about how you chose to go into healthcare and how you became a psychiatrist.
Sure. So that's kind of an easy one for me. I was always interested in psychology, psychiatry, how people's minds work, and how we can help people who are having challenges with their mental health. And so I actually went to medical school with the intention of being a psychiatrist. And I went to the University of Rochester, which really had a great focus on the biopsychosocial model and on primary care and how you could take care of the whole patient. So I came out of my second year thinking I was going to be a family doc. And then I learned the breadth of what family physicians need to do. And I said, nope, I'm a psychiatrist. So I refocused and went into my psychiatric residency in Madison, Wisconsin, and thought I was going to be a child psychiatrist, and then did my child rotation and decided that wasn't for me either. When I was a resident, there were a lot of young women who were just starting to take the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Those were pretty new back then, and so they were comfortable with the lack of side effects, unlike some of the older medications, and were getting pregnant and wanting to get pregnant. There was very little information about the safety and how to manage those medications during pregnancy. And so that became an interesting career path of mine in terms of perinatal, what became known as perinatal or reproductive psychiatry. So that's how I ended up in that.
Outstanding. Good, great story. And your career continued to evolve. So you've always had a big focus on medical education.
Yes.
And then in addition to that, you joined MaineHealth about the same time I did, about 2.5 or so years ago.
Yep.
And at that time, you came to us from the University of Vermont. University of Rochester, before you were... In addition to practicing psychiatry and teaching, you were also very engaged in diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yes. So I actually went to a fellowship in women's health, which was phenomenal for a couple years, and got my master's in epidemiology so I could do more research, and then was recruited back to the University of Rochester to the medical school and medical center, where I was for 22 years of my career and did a little bit of everything, or a lot of everything, actually. Clinical work, clinical administration, education administration in terms of residency, medical students, faculty development. Also did research in perinatal depression and anxiety. And then ended up circuitously ending up in the office for diversity, equity, inclusion, because there was one of the assistant deans moved to the university level and they needed somebody. So I said I would step in, help them and evaluate. And long story short, ultimately became the senior associate dean and vice president for the Medical Center for Inclusion and Culture. And so spent about a decade doing that work, which then people say, well, how'd you go from that to coming to Maine to lead education? So to connect those dots would be to say that the work that in DEI, which is so important, is often isolated. And a lot of the work we did was education across the continuum of education, so from pathway programs all the way through leadership, senior faculty, but also interprofessional, and across the health system as well as the medical school. And what I realized was that what I really wanted to do in the next phase of my career was develop and expand upon that continuum of interprofessional education and the continuum of education for providers in education and across the health system. And felt very fortunate that a colleague of mine who's in Maine told me about this position and said, I don't know if you're looking, which I wasn't really, but I said, I'll look at it, and was humbled to be chosen to come and lead the department following in Dr. Bob Bingyu's footsteps, who is still here and a mentor to me. So I've had a wonderful transition and feel very fortunate. So that's how I connect the dots for coming here.
Well, we feel very fortunate that you're here too. So, you know, medical education, you know, was always sort of a big part of Maine Medical Center. Does that mean that our medical education efforts are contained at Maine Medical Center?
No.
Tell us more about
that.
So,
as you were talking about rebranding and the expanse of everything we do, it's very similar for the Department of Medical Education. The department historically grew up at Maine Medical Center and also grew up very physician-focused. But that has evolved. Just like the system has evolved, the department has evolved. And we are impacting and a resource for all of Maine Health. So I thought I'd maybe just kind of go over what the department encompasses.
Sure.
Because I think, like I said, many people think about it as its history, which was very physician-focused, and everybody tends to know about medical students and residents, but we have much more to offer the system than that. So we are responsible for the Tufts Medical School, Maine Medical Center, Maine Track, which many people have heard of, which we have 40 Tufts medical students per year of medical school that are selected very specifically for the Maine Track. And the purpose of the Maine Track is to attract medical students who are from Maine, people who want to be in Maine and have a relationship to Maine, and people who want to do rural health care. Very focused mission for that track. The medical students do their first year in Boston and then years 2, 3, and 4 are with us. So they really identify with Maine as their home. But that's not the only medical students we have. We also work with University of New England, and we have at Southern Maine, we have 8 medical students doing their core rotations. But over the course of a year, we have up to 60 or more UNE medical students who rotate through. We also have about 100 Tufts medical students who rotate through over the year, and then we have medical students from all across the country. So the footprint of medical student education is much broader than I think many folks know. Then, of course, we have our residents and fellows. We have 33 residency and residencies and fellowships, three rural tracks. And we also have about 320 residents and fellows at this point. And as you said, we're going to continue to expand, which is really exciting. We have dentistry residents, which I think most people don't know, that we have relationships with Tufts Dental School, and we're responsible for 10 dentistry residents. We also started in 2021, right after I came to Maine, the Critical Care Advanced Practice Provider Residency Program, which recently got accredited, and it's the only accredited APP residency program in Maine. And that's really exciting because that's a new venture into different types of residency programs. We also do interprofessional education and provider education through a variety of ways, but the kind of overarching is the Maine Health Institute for Teaching Excellence, which really focuses on developing excellent teachers. And we have a scholars program as well as an academy. We do clinical education. We develop resources that are available on the web, on Canvas. And then we also have joint accreditation, which is the ability then not just to do CME education, but education credits for multiple professions through one program. And we've had over 350 of those events last year. So really phenomenal there. I have to think through the whole department. So then the next thing I would say is many people also know about the Hannaford Center for Safety, Innovation, and Simulation. And that is part of our department. Did over 600 events this past year. We also are responsible for all of the library services that are available across the system, and manage the Dana Center and some of those educational spaces, and then also have the Journal of Maine Medical Center. So I'm going to apologize to my colleagues for something that I'm sure I forgot, but it gives you a sense of the breadth of the department, which is really a system-wide sense of resources and support and education.
Yeah, it really is. It's pretty expansive. And
it is.
So I think it's safe to say we've got learners at virtually every location across the system.
And different types of
That's
learners.
Right.
Oh, and I forgot, and I will get in trouble. We also began to be the center for bringing in advanced practice provider students. We bring in about 100 PA and NP students across the system that then get disseminated across the system. So I'm sure I forgot something else too.
So for sure, having that many learners in our system helps us advance our strategic goal around becoming a learning healthcare organization.
No question.
And I think that's not just true for those who are learning, who are defined as learners, but I think it's true for all of us who engage with the learners to ensure that we're constantly pushing ourselves to know more, to be able to teach more, and instill that curiosity into the organization, which is so important. But do we retain any of these learners
Yes.
at Maine Health or within the state of Maine?
Yes. So when we look at our numbers, medical students who went through the Maine track, I just got the updated data of our alumni database. We have 81 graduates who are currently working in the state of Maine. So, and that's across the state of Maine, many of whom are in our system, but some that are elsewhere, but many of whom are training our current students and residents. So the future is in their hands and they are dedicated. Our residency programs keep about a third of our graduates stay in Maine. So as we expand those numbers, that will expand as well. In our new APP residency program, it's a small program, and in the first year we graduated two. One of those we were able to retain, and then another two, I believe we recruited both of them. So if we train folks, they want to stay with us, and I think that's a critical piece. One of the things I've heard is people come here to train, and then they've had such a wonderful experience training that they say, I'm going to stay.
Yeah.
So that's a thank you to everybody who's doing the teaching, because yeah. that's why people stay, is because yeah. of their experiences.
For sure. And so this is a big part of how we think about building our workforce for the future.
It is. We also have other components to think about the workforce. Our simulation center has been working with nursing academics, who's working with Southern Maine Community College, and we helped them to develop a simulation instructor course to support undergraduate nursing to do more simulations. So those tentacles go out in other ways. We also have multiple grants, the MERGE grant, which I'm sure you've heard about, which is a collaborative grant led by Dr. Callie Virakulis that brings in the systems across the state to expand the number of rural electives available. And I believe she said we're at 23 wow. new rural electives across the state. Nika Smith is leading the Building Maine grant, which also is looking at a platform and developing connections between our schools and clinical placements and sites for all different kinds of health professionals. So we have a lot going on there, and we also have a collaboration with University of New England. And Dr. Jen Heyman leads a AAMC CDC grant to develop novel ways to teach our clinicians around how to discuss health misinformation. So I think all of those contribute to our workforce as well.
Absolutely. And there are also some other practical applications of some of our education resources. And I think, for example, about the work the Sim Center has been doing to expand neonatal resuscitation programs
yes.
across our footprint and enabling our rural communities to stay current and up
no
to
question.
Date on the guidelines and being able to really provide that type of OB service.
No question. Yeah. They're also doing work around workplace violence.
Yeah.
And the resources that we have here are really, truly phenomenal to educate our clinicians in so many different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. In addition to all that you've described, we've also got some great partnerships in the community with other institutions of higher learning. Do you want to talk about any of those?
Sure. So as I said, we work with the University of New mm-hmm. England, not just around medical students, but around multiple health professions, and we recently developed a position with them around a liaison supporting some of the health professions so that there's direct communication, and that's a brand new, exciting role. As I said, we worked with UNE a lot around interprofessional education, and our grants with them. We're working with University of Southern Maine around some pathway programs, students who are interested in going into healthcare, and how can we help them to find their way and their path to whatever that happens to be. Tufts, obviously, is a large partner of ours, but not just for medicine, for advanced practice providers. They have a PA program as well as the dentistry. So we We also, as I said, are working with Southern Maine Community College and the multiple groups that the Nursing Academic Affairs Office is working with. So those are just a few of them.
Yeah, so it's really all about working together so our communities are the healthiest in America. So I hope everyone can clearly see the connection between our medical education and our vision. So really important. So Caroline, what do you think? Is it time for some questions?
We can certainly do some questions. We actually got one that came in about the rebrand work. So sure. I'm going to start there from Alex. Mm-hmm. Alex wanted to know if the rebrand was going to affect the practices at MMP and SMHP as well. Short answer is yes, but I'll let you give the long answer, Andy.
Yeah, it will. And it's important for a number of reasons. So as we combine those licensures, we have to have a consistent naming everywhere, not just to help our patients and to help each other, but frankly, our payers demand it. So it's Medicare regulations and all the private payers expect the same thing as well.
We got a question in email, and Linda's addressed some of it already, but I think it would be great if we could expand a little bit. Sarah had asked, wanting to know about the collaboration with the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine. She asked, what does this currently look like? Where do we see this going in the future? I think you've talked a little bit about where things currently mm-hmm. look like, but could you address that second half of the question? Where do we see this partnership going in the future?
Sure. Well, as you know, the University of New England Medical School is moving from Biddeford to Portland in the next, I don't know how long, they've broken ground, so that's exciting. We are currently working with them, as I said, down at Southern Maine. They do have core clerkships, which is their third year, and we also have begun to work with them in Portland at Maine Med. And then I think as we continue to grow that relationship and we have develop our learning health system and develop our rural sites to take more and more medical students, we will have more ability to work with them. We have a close working relationship with them, and they are a phenomenal partner.
Yeah, really are. And, you know, we've got a number of the graduates who are tremendous physicians in our system, residents in our system, fellows in our system as well. So we're very fortunate that they're in the neighborhood.
They're in the neighborhood and their graduates are with us and have a deep commitment to training future UNE medical students.
Yeah.
We also had a question from Jewel who said, since we have robust podcast programming, would it be possible for Maine Health to start offering a monthly educational podcast that provides CEUs, continuing education units, for nursing? The number of topics seems endless to be able to hear from experts across the organization that could speak directly to topics and issues within Maine Health would be invaluable.
Great idea. And that's exactly what Sharon Boffman, our chief nursing officer, said when we posed this question to her. So she said that they're working on a number of ways to create some free opportunities for continuing education units for nurses. Some of it may use our podcast stuff. Some of it may use some online available materials that are nationally published that can help with that as well. So more to come on that front. It's a great question.
Can I add to that question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if we develop them and we put them through our joint accreditation, then they can be used not just for nursing for credits, but for other disciplines.
Oh, so fantastic.
We can support that as well.
Outstanding. Thank you, Linda.
We have a question in the chat. Does the Department of Medical Education partner with colleges outside of Maine?
Outside of Maine, we do have visiting medical students from all over the country. So they do come through here from that perspective. We don't have direct relationships with other ones for medical students. We do for some of the advanced practice provider programs.
And of course, Tufts technically is in Massachusetts, so but
Tufts
we talked about
Tufts. Technically
is
in Massachusetts, but the main track is here.
It is right here, exactly. We love having those medical students here in Maine. We do have a couple questions regarding retention. Brian had written in saying, I had a great conversation with a patient who shared frustration with his frequent reassignment of his primary care provider within Maine Health. He said, past 2 years, he's been reassigned 3 times, and so he often finds himself at the walk-in clinic. Brian also went on to say that the patient works at a job outside of healthcare and it has a very generous PTO and paid leave policy. And so Brian was wondering if that might have some impact on retention and what Maine Health's plans for retaining providers are.
Yeah, you know, the years I practiced family medicine, it was never easy, but I don't know that it's ever been harder than it is today. And so we recognize that and are trying to do a number of things to make life better for our primary care physicians. And we think if we do that, that will certainly help with retention. And part of this is just trying to help rekindle the passion about why people went back into healthcare to really connect with patients. And I think in a lot of ways, live our vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America. So some of the things that we have done, we have extended the wellness bank for our physicians. Physicians who've been here for more than 10 years get more time off. We've instituted nurse triage for our primary care physicians, so they're no longer the first ones taking calls when they're on call. We're working on in-basket management. I've already started some of that. We'll be doing more things here shortly. We've continued to focus on things like expanding, you know, the artificial intelligence dictation of patient notes and patient encounters so the physicians never have to touch a keyboard. So we purchased 100 licenses for Nuance DAX to be able to do that, and we'll consider expanding that if there's interest among our physicians. So we've got a lot of work going on. There are more initiatives than the one I've already listed. And one of the big things we're doing this year is just listening and understanding what it's like to walk in those shoes and figure out other ways that we can try to get the pebbles out and make life easier for our primary care physicians.
I'm curious to what extent some of this expansion in medical education has an impact on retention as well. I imagine there are some physicians in rural areas that would love to be doing more teaching, and so being able to have some of this expansion could have an impact there.
I completely agree. I think that one of the things we hear is people love doing clinical care, but they love doing other things as well, whether it's a little bit of research or teaching. And I see those as things that help with retention because people get to do more and contribute to the future. They also love having learners and residents in particular. As we expand that, I think that will also support. But medical students, advanced practice providers, people want to give back, and they want to be able to train their successors.
And we have a sort of a similar question around nursing, but I think there probably is a different answer because these are different professions. Sally was saying that we know that we're in a nursing surge shortage. She's worked in multiple emergency departments. She's teaching nursing clinicals on med-surg floors. She said she sees a lot of nurses that are feeling tired and unappreciated and disposable, and they know there are a lot of travelers working. Wondering if there is a way to do more to keep nurses so that we don't have to rely on as many travelers?
Yeah, it's a great question, and there's a lot there to talk about. So for sure, you know, we want to do everything we can to continue to make the nursing profession as good as it can be too. And we've done a lot of work on that efforts, including creating great new governance structures, including, you know, raising pay pretty substantially for nurses over the last couple of years. If you look at nurses alone, it represents hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in compensation and pay. We've tried to come up with more attractive ways for people to earn extra time and extra shifts if that's something they want to do. We've also worked hard to reduce span of control, and we're in the process of rolling out some of that right now so newer nurses can get a lot of good feedback and do all the things that you know, they need to do with their supervisor directly. There's been a big focus on recognizing nurses and showing appreciation. I know they've done a lot of work on that at Maine Medical Center as well. And the good news is some of this is really working. So you may remember in our strategic plan, we had a 5-year goal to become top quartile in the whole industry in terms of retention and reducing turnover. We actually achieved that in 1 year. And so we are top quartile in the industry in turnover. Our turnover has dropped from the peak almost by about 20%. And, you know, we're significantly better on turnover today than we were back in 2019 before the pandemic hit. And so we've made a big difference there. Now, I got some tougher news, too, on the travel labor front. So when you stop and look at the United States right now, there's a deficit of 3 million healthcare workers to fill all the jobs that are available, which is an enormous number. Now, if you look at our shifting demographic trends over the next 10 years, our country is aging dramatically. So there's going to be over 100 million individuals, or close to 100 million individuals, in 10 years over the age of 65. Because of those changing demographics, there's only expected to be a net of 4 million new entrants into the job market over the next 10 years, which means to fill the $3 million person deficit we have today, 3 out of every 4 new job market entrants have to choose a healthcare profession. That's not going to happen, which means that we're going to have a gap for a long time. So the downside is that we're going to have a lot of travelers because we're going to need them to help fill the void. And it's not as good as having people here who are full-time, who are not renting but buying and really bought into the culture and all the things that we're trying to do as an organization. On the flip side, that means we'll have more people to do the work. And so we can try to do everything we can to reduce burnout and reduce some of the hard conditions that many of you have faced over the last few years. So it's not going to be an easy situation from that standpoint, but I'm really proud of what we've been able to accomplish in terms of reducing turnover.
We have just a couple more questions left from email. So if you have a question for the chat, now is a good time to put it in there. We got 2 questions that were very, very similar. So I'm going to squash them together, starting with Sarah. Sarah wanted to know if when we're posting open job positions, if there's a way that the posting could include the pay range for internal applicants, because she would love to see some more opportunities for growth, but doesn't know whether it's going to pay enough to make it worth it. And so the only way to do it right now is to go through the whole application process, which can be frustrating if you get to the end and realize you wouldn't get a raise. Susan asked a very similar question, also wondering if we could put information in our posting, such as how many hours a week, is it a day shift, what's the amount of flexibility we have around schedule.
Great question. So one of the challenges we have as a healthcare system is we sort of grew up as independent hospitals and healthcare networks. And now that we've really become one, you know, there are differences across the system around how things are, including how we pay for some jobs and how we've specified the responsibilities of those jobs. So as we sort of march together to becoming one team, working toward our vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America, we've got opportunities to start to standardize that, and our human resources team is working hard on that right now because we want to become more transparent about pay and make it easier for people to understand their career progression in terms of pay, but also, you know, when we're trying to attract talent so people understand coming to the door what to expect.
Finally, we have a question from Troy, which in some ways gets at what we were talking about with the rebrand and being one organization. Troy had sent us an article that had been written about a progressive think tank that asserted that healthcare costs go up for patients when hospitals and physicians' offices join systems like MaineHealth or Northern Light Health. He was hoping that you could address this issue, Andy, because he's gotten a lot of questions about this from his friends and family and wants to know what our position is on this.
Yeah, so I'm going to get you to hang in there with me on this answer because it's going to be long and complicated, but I think it's important that we talk about this. So from its inception, the federal government and the governmental payer programs like Medicaid have never covered the full cost of delivering care. And so the way we fill the gap is by charging more for commercially insured patients from their employer to fill that gap and get us to, you know, a break even or slightly above, ideally a 3% margin, so we can keep investing in all of you and all of the facilities and things that our patients need to deliver care. And that's the way the system has always been. Now, when you look at our costs at MaineHealth against the Medicare database, we're actually reasonably cost-effective. In fact, we're in the lower half of costs in terms of our care delivery, so we do pretty well there. When you look at commercial insurance rate in Maine, they're higher, but that's not necessarily because we're trying to throw our weight around and leverage our size to drive up the rates. The reality is we have a much larger Medicare eligible population because we're the oldest state in the nation. And we have a smaller group of working age eligible adults who have commercial insurance. And so in order to cover the costs of a broader Medicare population, we end up having to charge commercial insurance rates that are higher than you see elsewhere. And so for that reason, we've been attacked, we think, frankly, unfairly, and have tried to help people understand that that's not the case. Now, the reality is that part of the reason we've grown is because some of the systems within MaineHealth were struggling to survive on their own. And we're seeing this today. We're seeing that some of the other health systems in the state, particularly that those aren't part of a larger system, have had to reduce services. And we're feeling that brunt in some of our facilities. And so we would love to be able to help out, but we realize that's not going to be the case, that we're not going to have the opportunity to grow any larger within the state of Maine in particular. So when you think about the physician side, if you look at Medicare payments to physicians and you account for inflation, since 2000, physicians have effectively had a 26% pay cut over that period of time. So unless you're a physician that has some way of offsetting the cost of running your practice, such as rheumatologists that have infusion revenue, or gastroenterologists that have in-practice procedure revenue, then it's virtually impossible to kind of make it on your own, particularly if you're trying to care for the whole community. And so many of those physicians have sought refuge with integrated healthcare delivery systems, because that was the thing that was available to them in order to make that happen. That wasn't necessarily a strategic decision to try to create leverage against payers. It was really trying to preserve physician services in our communities, and that's especially true in our rural communities for sure. So I think some of these accusations are a bit unfair, and they're largely being driven by an organization called Arnold Ventures. So there's a young couple, they're about 50 years old, John and Laura Arnold. And Mr. Arnold made billions of dollars as an executive at Enron. And unlike many of his colleagues who went to jail, he walked away with billions of dollars, and now he's spending that money to influence political groups like the one that was referenced in politicians. And he has a point of view that the root of all problems in healthcare are not-for-profit healthcare systems and is attacking us, which is really a shame. Now, if you look at consolidation in healthcare, which is getting a lot of attention, and you think about things, we are for sure big in the state of Maine. We're $4 billion of revenue, probably the second largest company in Maine in terms of revenue. And we're the largest private employer with 23,000 employees. So we're a big organization within Maine. But compared to, for example, some of our health insurance companies, we're nothing. So United Healthcare is $400 billion of revenue, significantly larger than 100 times larger than us. Anthem is $163 billion of revenue. They're 40 times bigger than us. And when you look at consolidation in the healthcare delivery side, healthcare systems like us, and you take the top five healthcare systems across America and look at their percent of market share based on revenue, it represents 1.7% of the entire healthcare delivery market. But if you look at the top five health insurance companies, based on market share, they represent 70% of the commercial health insurance market. So I would argue the consolidation in healthcare is a real problem, but on the insurance side, not on the care delivery side. So we're going to always do every single thing we can to be responsible to our communities. So last year, when we recognized just to break even, we needed to close a $135 million gap. We effectively asked the payers to help us close about $30 to $35 million of that gap. The rest we have found internally. We worked hard, many of you worked hard, to help figure out ways we can save dollars, and we saved about $92 million last year to help us get closer to break even. And we did that intentionally, not asking the commercial payers for more, because we knew that was going to get passed on to our employers in Maine. And we need our employers in Maine to be incredibly successful with us, because if they're not successful creating jobs, creating opportunities for employment and housing, and creating other businesses to support them, we're never going to achieve our vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America. As we've talked about before, the health of a community is largely tied to the economic welfare of a community. And so we need our employers to be successful. And we've had lots of conversations with our employers about that to help them understand what we're trying to do. And at the same time, delivering healthcare is expensive. Our biggest cost item is all of you. 60% of our costs are labor. And you all have expected to get paid more over the last few years. And we've done that. And we're largely a pass-through business. There's not a lot else out there. We pass through our expenses to those employers to make up the gap of what we get paid from the federal government and the state government. We're grateful that it looks like we've seen increased Medicaid rates passed by the Maine state legislature yesterday. And so we're grateful for that, and that'll hopefully create some relief, but we will always be responsible in thinking about what we're asking from the commercial insurers and our employers to help support the cost of care.
All right. And we did get one more question in the chat while you were talking. And I don't know if this is a Linda question or an Andy question. So I'll just ask it and you guys can fight over it. Rodney wanted to know, if we continue to expand teaching, research, and time away for physicians, how does that get paid for out of all those pennies?
You want me to take that one? Okay, I'll take that. It has to get paid for. And so the reality is that time away from seeing patients is expensive. And it's expensive because we don't generate revenue in the moment when those physicians are in clinic, for example, and it means they're seeing less patients that may ultimately end up in our hospitals or have surgery or imaging, which also generates revenue too. So we have to balance all that for sure. But at the same time, while we have to balance all that, we have to do all of that. So education and research are called out in our mission, as is clinical care. And so that's why we exist. So we will always be engaged in academics and research, educating the next generation of caregivers and researching better ways to give care, as our mission statement states. And we'll have to figure out how we balance all that fiscally, because it is expensive for sure.
All right, that is it for our questions. We are going to move on to recognitions. Linda sent us a fantastic slide for her recognition, so I'm excited for her to talk about this one.
Sure, happy to. There we go. So I chose this slide because when I was asked to recognize someone or some component, I couldn't recognize some individual or individual part of the department. I want to recognize our whole department. And last Tuesday, we had our annual event where we come together and celebrate one another. And we were bowling, and we had just a phenomenal time. And I was so grateful that out of a department of about 80, more than 50 people showed up. And I just want to thank everyone in our department for doing amazing work that really supports the education and the advancement of our learners across the whole system. So I just want to thank everyone in the Department of Medical Education.
Yeah, here. It's an incredible team.
It is an incredible team. Yeah, I'm very grateful.
Absolutely. Linda, thank you for being with us today. All right, I've got great recognition for a member of the Access to Care team, but it reflects the quality of work this team does every day to support our patients and connect them with available resources. Leanne Butler was very helpful in navigating many things during my time with breast cancer. She reached out to me and made so many things happen that at the time I was unable to do and truly didn't know what was available. She helped me with paperwork on the phone and always had a positive attitude. Most importantly, she encouraged me to apply for SSDI a second time after I was rejected the first time. We did, and it literally changed my financial life. Please recognize Leanne's devotion and knowledge. She is a wonderful employee, and her patients are lucky to have her in their court. Thanks, Leanne, and to all of our Access to Care team members for your commitment to our patients and our vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America. We've got an awesome patient experience recognition that is really about being patient-centered, empathetic, but also inclusive, which is awesome. So at our last recognition is about Dr. Linda Houck from Maine Medical Partners Dermatology in South Portland. Dr. Houck is so knowledgeable and welcoming. I always enjoy my appointments with her. She takes time to explain everything. And instead of pushing her opinion on me, she gives me the relevant information and respects my individual experiences and values. I would venture to say that Dr. Houck is the most competent non-BIPOC doctor I've ever worked with. She recognizes the way my race and ethnicity impact my health and hair. I left the office feeling listened to, respected, and well-informed about my next steps. Dr. Houck, thank you so much for your exceptional patient-centered care. All right, next open door is February 21st. I'm not going to be here, but Kelly Elkins will be here, and we're going to have Dr. Bob Carlson from Nordex. If you haven't had a chance to be exposed to him, he's wonderful, and I think that's going to be a great program. In the meantime, I continue to kind of hide an Easter egg here on the set. Nobody's commented on it yet, so hopefully somebody will at some point. And before next time, make sure that you're positively identifying the patient in front of you and washing your hands before you engage in care. Thanks so much, and we'll see you soon.